So the talk's on three insights that free the heart. There's a Zen master, and his student, or her student, is across the stream. And the student yells out, "Master, how do I get to the other side?" And the Zen master says, "You are on the other side." So it's just, it's a tiny little nice story, because we're always trying to get somewhere else. And we think the path is to get somewhere else, and it's always to arrive right here. And the reason we want to arrive right here, for lots of reasons, we're just a lot happier. If we're just, like, dropped out of all the stories and drama and just into our simple experience, it's a relief. So our nervous system is somehow built to where we're quite happy if we can just be hearing something, tasting something, seeing, feeling, you know, if we're in our physical senses. But we're so addicted to being in the mind that it's rare for us, you know? And you have to be a musician or a poet or an artist or work with your hands somehow to get into your senses. Otherwise, we're just all the way up here, you know, above the eyebrows. And it's problematic for lots of reasons. The biggest problem is that our thoughts can't capture the way reality is. And thoughts are really helpful, that we can think about things and we can say, yeah, let's get together tonight. And we both know what that means, so that's helpful. But the way thoughts are out of whack with reality in so many ways is why we suffer so much. And there's not just, you know, it's not just individual. There's also, then we built a society that's not fair and unjust on social issues, racial issues, class issues. We build a lot of suffering into our society based on our basic inability to understand the world properly through our thoughts. And we want to engage the thoughts that are useful, and we want to let go of the ones that are not. So we're not trying to get rid of thinking. We're really trying to wake up to thinking so that we see what's helpful and what isn't. Period. And so the Buddha taught these three characteristics as a way of aligning us with how things actually are, apart from our thoughts. So our thoughts are like, I had a nice chat, I had a nice run, I had a nice meditation, and what am I doing? That's out of whack with reality, those thoughts. Because I'm taking flow, a talk, a run, a meditation, it's just flow, and I'm turning it into something, like it's a banana. But what was your meditation? It was just a lot of changing experience. And so was the chat, and so was the run. So one of the ways we really obscure how things are is with this kind of freezing reality and blinding us to the fact that everything is changing so much. It's all flow. And so Jack Kornfield likes to use a cartoon about impermanence, and there's a Bedouin family traveling across a desert landscape, and they're on a camel, and then there's a father and a mother and three kids, and the father, in a clearly annoyed expression, is turning around to the kids and saying, "Stop asking if we're almost there yet. We're nomads, for crying out loud. When are we going to get there?" And so we know change, the first of the three characteristics, and let me just review. So change is the first. What's the second characteristic of every experience?
Unreliable.
Yes. If it's changing, you can't rely on it to stay the same. And the Pali word for that is dukkha, mistranslated as suffering. It's more nuanced than that. Because we can be having a good time, and if we're not sort of down with the fact that it can change, we're going to suffer when it does change. So this unreliability isn't just about having a bad mood. It's really about just everything we're doing when we're depending on things that are actually going to end up changing. And what's the third characteristic of every experience?
Self.
Yeah. And what's another way to say not self?
Interdependence.
Interdependence, uh-huh. And another way to say not self is no essence. If something doesn't have an essence, it is interdependent. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, how does he say it?
Inter-is.
Yes, things inter-are. Right, thank you. Right? So our conceptual mind blinds us to these three truths. Our experience, very simply, shows us the three truths. And when we experience the three truths, we let go. And when we let go, we're already happy. We see like the sun has been shining behind the clouds the whole time. The happiness just is there because we've let go. So we it's like a cliche to say everything changes. And we can review literature, media, we see it everywhere. So here's Basho, a Japanese haiku poet from the 17th century. Summer grasses, all that remains of warriors' dreams. Can you feel the impermanence in that? You know, in a battlefield somewhere. And here's Kevin Garnett, basketball player for the Boston Celtics back in 2008, after winning 19 games in a row. Most winning team in NBA history, or the biggest winning streak, I guess. And their streak ended in the next game against the Lakers. But before their streak ended, Kevin Garnett was quoted, "Unless you win it all, it's pretty much steam in the air. You see it and it evaporates." So he's down with impermanence in a big way. And I'll just read a little excerpt of the poem Ozymandias from Shelley. And he's talking about being in the desert and seeing a pedestal, kind of a scattered statue in the sands. And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away." Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. For a while. And then all he is a broken sculpture in the wilderness. So we get it. It's a cliche, everything changes. We get it intellectually, but it doesn't change us. It's just an idea in our head. We have to realize it. And we realize it by experiencing it. We see it. It's happening. We can't argue with it. If you're working with sensations and you're watching sensations come and go, you know that this body, you know, is like a waterfall. There's just stuff bubbling around in the body. And our ideas, again, are very contradictory to it. Our ideas just talk about the body like it's this thing. But when we experience it, we just see flow. And the thing is, if you're conscious, the change goes from an enemy to an ally. Because all the change is telling you something. It's telling you, I'm not your refuge. You can't rely on me. And if there was no other alternative, this would be pretty depressing. But there's a real alternative. We're so fixated on things, and that's like the other side. You know, we're trying to get to the other side. We're so fixated on having experiences as things, and we don't see that it's flow. And so all our allegiance is in the things. And I'm talking about today shifting our allegiance so that we're more interested in the knowing itself. And that's our refuge. The refuge of knowing is the way we can really find the peace that Ajahn Chah talked about. If we just keep knowing, 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 being mindful of what's happening, then the flow is fine. And then actually we see the flow as benevolent. The rug is being pulled out so that you look deeper. And there are different approaches to what's deeper. You know, this is the Buddhist approach through mindfulness and loving kindness practice. So this is kind of, you know, the Buddhist answer to, well, what is your refuge if it isn't in the changing things? It's the awareness of the changing things. And another refuge is love. You know, we can always be aware and we can always remember to love. And everything can change and do its dance, but we can, like, park in those refuges. Presence and love. And really, you know, change is hard. Especially, you know, we like change as we, you know, are young. And we all want to get older when we're young. But then, you know, we hit the peak, and then we all want to go back to being young, but instead we're just getting older. So, you know, we called it maturing before, we liked it, but for a lot of us now we call it aging, and we don't like it. And so, you know, our minds are, you know, I didn't think I had my mic here, and I was looking around for it. And there it was, right in my pack, but it was just a little deeper than I thought. You know, there's a cartoon of two dinosaurs sitting on a tiny piece of ground, and there's a large boat with animals in pairs receding into a massive rainstorm. And one dinosaur is saying to the other, "Oh, crap, was that today?" So this, and maybe we go from the serenity prayer to the senility prayer. So aging isn't, it seems like that's a curse. How could that be something helpful? I remember once when my wife Lisa and I moved from Vermont to Colorado, and we were moving, and it was like 2 in the morning. We were still packing up for our apartment. We, you know, had to drive the car away the next morning. And I walked out of my bedroom with something in my hand, and I kicked something, and I looked down, and there was a statue of a Buddha without its head. And I had kicked off the head of the Buddha, which, you know, we like to have reverence towards the Buddha because it's so much about us waking up. So that was not a good moment. And yet it was the universe trying, it was the Buddha trying to tell me to wake up. You know, so how is aging? I mean, this seems like a curse. And then mortality, dying. You know, well, the Buddha said, and there's in Buddhist cosmology, you don't have to buy into this at all, but in the Buddhist cosmology, there's deities and there's hell realms, and then there's the human realm. And the human realm is the only realm we can get enlightened. So gods are living in, you know, for centuries with total pleasure. They can't get enlightened. And then beings in the hell realm have too much suffering to be motivated. Either way, too much pleasure, too much pain, there's no motivation. In the human realm, there's enough pleasure and enough pain to motivate us to look deeper. And so we could think of all the change and all the discomfort it creates is a positive if you buy into this path. If you buy into this path, you can say the universe is wanting you, conspiring to wake you up. And so you'll make mistakes, and the mistakes will wake you up, will make you want to pay attention. You'll kick off the head of a Buddha and be aghast and realize, oh, the universe wants me to pay attention. So when your sweetheart, you know, changes, that's the universe wanting you to pay attention. When something changes at work, when your kids are changing, when your parents are changing, when you're changing, that's the universe wanting you to pay attention. You can always wake up to this moment, just like we're doing today, and be, oh, it's like this. And so at Buddhist funerals, the chant is done to remind people that everything's impermanent. Everything is interdependent with everything else and arises and passes away, including our bodies. But the chant ends by saying to be in harmony with this truth is true happiness. The impermanence, if you can learn to dance, the impermanence is telling you to let go. And when you let go, you're happy. So all this impermanence is here so that you will look for the real refuge of awareness and love. And if you have this deeper kind of calling in your life where you get it that being aware is truly important to you. You want to be in the moment more. You want to be able to let go when something's difficult and come back. And so the Buddha said that seeing deeply into this truth of change is enough to liberate us, enough for us to awaken or enlighten completely. And the Buddha said, you can do this. He wouldn't ask us of us if we couldn't do this. the Buddha was not some special figure, didn't achieve something that we can't achieve. And the way impermanence helps you let go is the more mindful you become, the more you will notice things changing. And there's a time in practice, as practice deepens, where it's somewhat, it's sort of like, you know, going through turbulence on an airplane. You get not dizzy, but you just get kind of discombobulated because things are changing so fast. They're changing so fast because you're not feeding it with your resistance. You're just letting things be as they are, and then sounds are coming, sensations are coming, thoughts and images. It all speeds up. And if we keep trying to hang on, we get, you know, disturbed. So we just let go and watch the show happen. And then we're backing into well-being. We just get happy when we're just resting in awareness. And then the faster your experience changes, the less you're like getting involved. You're still in it. You wake up inside your experience. But it doesn't define you. It doesn't limit you. Because you're this awareness. And the way it works is it's like we see that our experience is like a waterfall. Sounds, sights, thoughts, images, it's all coming and going really fast. And there's lots of ways to relate to a waterfall. Take a shower, take a photograph of the pretty rainbow, but what you wouldn't do is lean on it. You just naturally aren't going to lean on a waterfall. And so this is the way we let go. It's almost like we don't have to let go. All we have to do is see impermanence. And the impermanence is like reality letting go of you. It's the impermanence that does the letting go, because you don't want to lean on a waterfall. It would be silly. And so this is how you get. You just get more sort of at ease and upright, and letting your experience come and go, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pleasure, the pain, it can all come and go. Because you are so interested in knowing what's happening. So change is our ally. It's doing the letting go for us. If we're willing to take refuge in awareness and love, the two things that we can always do, if we remember, we can always know how it is, and we can always open to love. So, any questions about any of that? Anyone want to add something here, question or comment, in working with impermanence before I go on to the next one? Please.
Would it be the same thing as not latching on to it? I mean, not Pema Chodron uses, don't bite the hook.
Right.
Is that the same thing?
Yeah.
You're talking about?
I mean, don't bite the hook is maybe the result of our practice. The more we notice our experience, the less we get hooked by it, right? And there is a place for not biting. Like when you realize, oh, this is a train of thought that I just know is not helpful, you can purposefully shift your attention away, right? So that might be at least my version. I don't know exactly how Pema meant that when she said that, but it's like, yeah, I'm going to be like, just don't go there, because I know that's a dead end of suffering. So I'm going to just turn my attention somewhere else. That's a way of letting go. It's a little different, though, when you're just letting it be exactly as it is. You're not trying to not bite. You're trying to notice what's happening. And that's where the letting go happens to you.
Okay.
You're just, what you're doing is you're allowing things to be impermanent. So you don't really have to let go. It'll let go of you if you let it. The way you let it is you keep noticing how it is. Oh, it's like this. It's like this. It's like this.
So it's the holidays, and I keep thinking about family dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you handle things that are coming your way in the moment, in a bunch of people that always trigger you anyway? How does one do that?
Well, if we're getting triggered by family, we're getting triggered into big stories, and usually our big karmic knots. And these are things that, we can be triggered into shame, unworthiness, all kinds of things. And we've thought them 10,000 times. we have to take care of the present moment, like in the sense that, if we're getting triggered, that's ours, and we have to own it as ours. And also, if there's a family dynamic that's painful and not healthy for us, we also need to sidestep it as best we can, without knowing the specifics. But remember, it's all impermanent. The family gathering's impermanent. How you feel when you're triggered is impermanent. This is where the kindness really comes in. We have to be really kind to ourselves, because our families are going to bring up our habits more than anywhere else, right? Maybe our partner also, but our partner's really bringing up our family stuff. So we have to be really kind and forgiving to ourselves. God, I cannot believe, I'm 60 years old and I still have this pattern. That's not helpful. What you have is this moment. And whether it's been going on for 60 years or not, or you're afraid it's going to keep going, doesn't matter. There's this one right now. And that's what we relate to as much as possible, just this. And especially with family, we're going to go into big stories. And especially if we're triggered and we have a lot of pain, we use big stories to defend. So we have to acknowledge the big stories, but realize it's not really helpful at all to put energy into them. But with kindness, we keep coming back to this moment, and we're with our experience, however it is. And it's painful, but it's okay. We can be with it if we're willing. It's a big question. So this, it might be a good segue into the next thing, which is dukkha. Is the second characteristic, or unreliability. So if we are going to be with family, right? The problem, if happiness has a lot to do with our expectations being met, holidays are hard because it's supposed to be all like cheer and good times and, fuzzy little things. And... and instead, his family. So the Buddha talked about dukkha, again, often translated as suffering, but better translated as unreliable. But the kind of stereotype of this religion, like, oh my God, the first noble truth, everything's suffering. And then we have our heavenly messengers. Does anyone know the heavenly messengers?
Yeah.
Buddhist heavenly messengers. It's the three things the Buddha saw before Prince Siddhartha, before he left the palace. His father shielded him from all suffering. So he left the palace for the first time when he was like in his late 20s. So the legend goes. What was the first thing he saw? Yeah, a sick person. Believe it or not, he'd never seen a sick person. And then he went out another time and saw an aging person. He went out a third time and saw a dead person. Had never seen any of these before. And it totally turned his head. There was a prophecy that the prince was either going to be the ruler of the kingdom or a spiritual teacher. And the dad definitely did not want his son to be a spiritual teacher. So he shielded him from everything, you know, difficult so that the prince would not have a spiritual life. So these are the heavenly messengers. This is Dharma, Buddhist Dharma for you. Aging, illness, and death. Forget puffy clouds with little angels and harps and things. This is our religion. And then, now this is Theravada. Other Buddhist traditions hold it differently. But in Theravada, you keep coming back. You're reborn again and again because of attachment. Attachment to dukkha. But if you get fully enlightened, you never come back again. This is a sucky religion. So if I've got it right, as long as life sucks, I'm going to come back. But once it doesn't suck, I never come back.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. Come on. So... not. So there is a fourth heavenly messenger. What's the fourth? What did the Buddha see, or the Buddha to be see, the fourth time he left the palace? Yeah, a renunciate, a spiritual practitioner. And the Buddha decided that day he was leaving the palace and was going to be a spiritual seeker. So it sounds pretty morbid with the first three, but it's the first three that are the spurs to your practice. Impermanence, you know, the fact that we die, makes us look deeper. So it turns us to the path. These are good things then. And so the Buddha really, out of compassion, wanted us to see deeply the way something changing, like, isn't your jam. It isn't what is your place to really take refuge, because it can't give you the lasting happiness you want. And, you know, we know how to be happy when it's pleasant. And that works as long as the pleasant stays, but when unpleasant comes or neutral comes, we don't know how to be happy. And this is dukkha. This is why our business as usual doesn't work that well. So, for example, this is on NPR a while back. A record producer, Joe Smith, who produced greats like Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, David Bowie, Jerry Garcia, George Harrison. He produced a lot of really famous musicians. And he interviewed them just kind of off the cuff here and there, and he ended up writing kind of a memoir about it. And he wrote about Ray Charles talking about Artie Shaw, and Artie Shaw, jazz musician, but anyone, it's old school, so anyone know what Artie Shaw, was he clarinet or something? Anyway, Ray Charles is just talking about Artie Shaw. I love him so much, man. I almost cry literally tears when he stopped playing. I think there was some health issue where Artie Shaw couldn't play anymore. Ever since I was a kid, he was the guy I loved so much. Artie Shaw, to me, had so much feeling in his notes. Every note, you could feel his heart. I have to tell you, man, it's like a person dying when Artie Shaw couldn't play anymore. So you can just feel the passion and the love of the music. So he was being, Joe Smith, the producer's being interviewed on NPR. And the NPR interviewer asked, when you finished doing the interviews over those 2 years, did you find you came away from it with any kind of conclusions about what qualities a lot of these artists shared? So Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, David Bowie, you know, wow, what do they all have in common, you know? Passion, creativity, whatever. Wow. Here's what Joe Smith said. I felt that if there was one emotion that went through the old ones and the new ones, it was insecurity. The next record, is that going to be a hit? Are they going to continue to be stars and be idolized? Because everybody has the moment when their records were on the charts, the moment when the crowds were at their concerts, and then the moment passes. They're still big and important, but they're not the moment anymore, and that bothers them. You know, musical geniuses, but insecurity being the common thread. Because, you know, things go your way. And then things change. The way we could kind of sum up this unreliability is that our experiences are slippery. Fame is slippery. Achievement is slippery. We need to do it. We want to do it. But if we're more focused on the process is always there. But more focused on the process, not so much the achievement. You know, I mean, these people wanted to make a living playing music. Some people are really motivated by fame, but most musicians are motivated just for their love of music, and they want to just be able to make a living at it, and fame helps. So if we can be less focused on the result and more focused on just what we love to do, we're happier. We don't get turned over so much. Things are slippery. How was your lunch? I love to eat in my head and in my heart, you know, but in the actual experience, it's pretty slippery. It's nice, but it's just flow. It doesn't really land somewhere. I mean, yeah, it lands down here. But in your experience, it doesn't really land. It just flows, and it's nice. Oh, that first bite, you know, of a quiche or something. Oh, right? But then you chew. It's like, okay, I got to swallow because it's just getting mushy, right? It changes. It's not that just perfect little, you know, egg and crust and, right, cheese. It changes. That's a pointer to you. What if you were just really psyched to just keep being aware of what's happening? Then when the meal ends, okay, now you're aware with the meal ending. You just keep being aware. That's your refuge. So Talking Heads said, watch out, you might get what you're after. So the thing about dukkha is that, you know, we have this idea, we want something, but then we get it, and it's kind of like, oh, okay, fine. You know, we have some mystique about it, but then when we get it, it's ordinary. Or there's things that are just so beautiful, your heart kind of aches, you know? Like the sunset. And it's like you want to bottle it, you want to capture it, you want to grab it, possess it, have it. But you can't. It's just a sunset. It's really nice. But you're wanting more from it. You want to squeeze it. And really, why is a sunset beautiful? Because it's fleeting. If it was just there all the time, whatever, you know, we don't notice it. So there's another Basho I quoted before, another great little haiku from him, sort of about this thing where even when you have something that's precious, you want more from it. He said, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto. Now, this is not to make us morose. This is really, the Buddha was so practical. What works? And, you know, to chase the fleeting things just doesn't work so well. It works for a while. But we need something more reliable. All right, since we're talking about dukkha, let me lighten it up a tiny bit. There was a funny thing in the New Yorker about Santa Claus, who had just come back from a meditation retreat into a Santa outfit, since it's Christmas. So Wayne, age 4, is in Santa's lap, crying, "Wah! Why are you crying, precious one? Dylan kicked me. Give me a present." "Ah, I see. Well, did you know that you've already received a gift today?" Wayne, "What do you mean?" "Well, when we experience dukkha, or suffering, we're given a chance to more deeply understand the temporary nature of things. Just as suffering must end, so will pleasure. Your pain is a doorway to enlightenment." He sounds just like me. "I lovingly encourage you to see what lies beyond it. But I want a Nerf gun. Happiness and sorrow replace one another cyclically. The wheel turns. All is fleeting." Ella, age 6. "Santa, I love you. Are you so excited it's Christmas?" "That's a complicated question." "I'm troubled by the holiday's tendency towards consumerism, yet I'm drawn to the joy and light that the season also brings. It's a good time of year to remind ourselves that there's but a fine line between attachment and aversion. Ultimately, I look forward to the clean, untarnished slate the new year promises." Dakota, age 9. "Santa, hi. Great to see you. I've been pretty good this year. My analyst says I'm making progress on my aggression issues, so I'm just going to jump in with my wish list. I've got a PowerPoint queued up on the tablet here, and then we can circle back on the details since I know we're both busy." Fascinating. "Okay, I'm going to need these chunky Steve Madden ankle boots, an infinity scarf from Lululemon, and a Kate Spade cover for my iPhone 6. Sound good? I'm going to suggest something even better. A gift you can only give yourself, freedom from desire. The Dharma teaches us that only when we shed the weight of our own cravings can we achieve enlightenment. WTF. Okay. So this was the easy part. Now we're going to take up the third characteristic, and this is the hard part, because this is the one that everyone gets confused with. Not self. Of course I'm a self. Who's listening right now? Who drove here, you know? Who's meditating? There has to be a little mini-me in here pulling the strings. Well, let's take a look. So if we assume if there's a self, that there's an essence, there's the little mini me that is my essence. But without looking at the me, because that's harder, let's just look at something like, how about a banana? What is the essence of a banana? If there was a banana sitting here, the way our language is, there is a banana here, okay, it's something. Our language assumes essence. So what's the essence? Well, I'll just say a few things. It's assuming, when we say essence, what we mean is something that's singular, right? We've boiled it down to the essence, the one thing this thing is. We're also... the essence doesn't change. The rest of me can change, but I've still got the essence. That doesn't change. And this essence is independent. So, you know, the banana is, the essence of banana, you know, is different from orange or tomato or cloud. There's something independent. But try to find that. What's the single thing a banana is? Well, it's got skin, it's got, you know, the fruit, but it's got those little, I don't even know what you call them, the little things you that can pull away, little tiny seeds inside. Which of those parts is the essence? We call it a banana. It's not one thing. It's a bunch of things in a little yellow skin. Is it, you know, does it change? Heck yeah. You know what's cool about a banana tree? The tree grows every year. From a seedling. It's an annual, can grow 30 feet in a year and make all those bananas. That is not an unchanging thing. So one banana just came from this tree that grew 30 feet in a year. Independent? Good luck, right? We all know all the factors that go into growing a plant. You can't find the essence. Nothing is singular, independent, and unchanging. You know, what's the single thing in you that hasn't changed since you were a little baby? And we're so many parts, we're always changing. And we're so interdependent, we can't take a breath, you know, without being reliant on the oxygen in the air. So on an intellectual level, though, this is, we can logically do this. For most of us, that doesn't change much. It's sort of like the idea of change. You know, it doesn't change us much. We have to really see it. We have to realize it. Well, you think of your body as you, right? I mean, it's not... doesn't belong to the person next to you. It's yours. But who's digesting your food right now? And who's pumping your blood? And who's taking that food and breaking it into little parts and distributing it through the body? Who's in charge of that? Are you doing that on purpose right now? Sitting here, digesting your food, willing for it to happen? Are you pumping your blood? This is me, and yet all this stuff is happening without our will. And so we can reflect this way, and this is a little easier to understand. We can sort of feel our body is like, oh, right, right. This isn't so much me, because it's doing all this stuff. But the mind is where we really get hooked. We assume there has to be a me in the mind. And that's a topic for another day, because it's a big one. But I want to kind of direct us more to something easier. And what's easier is this advice from the Buddha. And he was speaking to someone who had asked him a question about his practice, Bhayiya. And he said, Bhayiya, train yourself thus. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. When you train yourself thus, Bhayiya, there is no you there. When there's no you there, this is the end of suffering. And as a lot of the stories go, Bhayiya became an arhat, fully enlightened just from that instruction. So, did anyone get there? What the Buddha is saying is, in your sensory experience, your physical experience, there isn't a me. So if you would, just, you know, come back into your body. And maybe feel one of your hands. And I want you to distinguish the sensation that you're feeling from any image you might have of the hand. So the sensation maybe is pulsing, buzzing, throbbing, tingling, something like that, right? That's a physical experience. If there's an image of the hand, that's a mental recreation, right? You're imagining this. It's not the actual sight of the hand, because your eyes are closed. It's an image. And we want to just distinguish the tingle, buzz, pulse, or throb, whatever's in the hand. Notice that it's different from the image. And now notice, are you having any thoughts about your hand? Even as simple as my hand. You want to notice the thought is not the sensation. It's a mental label. It's words in the mind. And we're not making that go away. We just notice it's not the sensation. Come back to sensation. And then let's try one other thing here. This will also show you your physical experience. It doesn't have a me in it. The me is in the thoughts or the images that you create in the mind. The physical sense doesn't have that in it. It's just tingle. It's just throb, buzz, pulse. There's no me in it. This is the easiest way to understand. The me is a creation of the mind. And let's do it one more way. So now take one of your fingers and bend it backwards with your other hand to the point of discomfort. You could go all the way to pain if you wanted. You're going to hold it for a little while, but just discomfort's fine. And then use the awareness we've been working with. Notice the sensation of discomfort. Notice the size of it. You know, the intensity, is it mild, strong? You can even notice, is it changing or not? Okay. So, where did the sensation end? If it went past your wrist, raise your hand. Okay? Did it go past the elbow for anyone? Okay, so somewhere below the elbow, the pain had a boundary, the discomfort. Did you notice the discomfort going through the arm, up through the shoulder, into the brain to light up the little area called mini-me? And the mini-me's in pain. You noticed that. Mm-hmm. Pain went, I mean, were you really pushing hard?
I was just, it was sort of a environmental pain.
Oh. Do you think it went all the way up? Or, I mean, when you say environmental pain.
It was just kind of an aura of discomfort.
Okay. Well, sometimes we do experience pain that way. But that's why, you know, the thing about finding the boundary and locating it. And that can be hard. We don't always easily locate something. Usually what happens is we notice there's pain somewhere in the body. And then we make up the concept that it's happening to me. It's pain somewhere happening to me. But really our experience is just pain in a location. The mind supplies the rest and says it's happening to me. And if you're working with physical pain, a little helpful little thing that helps you be with it more is say pain in space. Because the assumption is pain happening to me. But our experience is not that. Our experience is of pain in a location, which you can summarize as pain in space. That is nice. It actually helps you sit with physical pain more because you don't have that illusion that it's somehow lighting up the little mini you in pain. It's not. It's just pain somewhere. So this is hard to get. The part that's easy to get is that in our pure physical experience, we don't find a me. We just find tingle or throb. If we're seeing, we just see colors. If we're hearing, we just hear sounds. That's what the Buddha said. When in the seen is just the seen, and in the heard is just the heard, there is no you there. And that's the end of suffering. Because it's the end of your separateness. When there isn't a you, it's a massive relief. So these three things, change, unreliability, not self, help us let go. And they also motivate us to realize that awareness and love is where we can find reliable happiness. If our life is about loving well and about being aware, it's a really tried and true path to happiness. So I will stop with that. And just see for you, is there any input, any comments or questions?
In Buddhism, there is this idea of true nature.
Yeah.
Is true nature just our present moment awareness, or something else?
I'll repeat it. Is true nature present moment awareness or something else? I mean, in the Mahayana traditions, Zen and Tibetan, we talk about Buddha nature. And actually, the traditions talk about it differently. So I can only, I've studied in the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And in that tradition, they talk about true nature as pure awareness. Awareness without effort. There's no one here being aware. There's just pure awareness. And that is the nature of mind.
Is that the same as the kind of present moment awareness we do in Vipassana?
Yes, but in Vipassana, it's dualistic and it's with effort. There's a me here, my breath's over there, and I'm noticing it. Now, it heads to non-dual over time. But our path is more of using this kind of skillful duality. But in there's various traditions where it's all about just opening to pure awareness. If we use the word awareness, which is the knowing what's happening, there can be awareness with effort and focus and awareness without effort or focus. And that's more the pure awareness. Ours is more awareness with effort and focus, which heads to pure awareness.
That's actually quite helpful. I never heard anybody say it quite that way, so thank you.
Sure. Okay, well, let's stop here.